Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The dust has not settled on those reports that President Trump shared classified information with Russian diplomats last week. The president tweeted this morning that he wanted to share with Russia, which I have the absolute right to do, facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety. And in a press briefing today, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster repeated what he said yesterday, that contrary to the first report in the Washington Post, the president did not compromise intelligence sources or methods.
He shares information in a way that is wholly appropriate. And I should just make maybe the statement here that the president wasn't even aware, you know, of where this information came from. He wasn't briefed on the source or method of the information either. So I'm sorry, this is going to be the last question because we do have the president of Turkey coming, I think, momentarily. Thank you very much.
Well, joining us for the latest is NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Robin.
Well, yesterday, H.R. McMaster said that Donald Trump did not reveal classified sources or methods. Today, he and President Trump both acknowledge that he did, but defended his right to do so. They are correct in saying that a president is right to do that, but what are the concerns?
Well, the concerns are the significance of this information. It was very, very sensitive information about what ISIS might be doing with a laptop computer and trying to carry out an attack on a plane. So this is not something you'd want to share with the Russians. There's also the question of protecting the source. This information came from a U.S. ally, which didn't want it being shared widely and certainly not with the Russians. So it's the real sensitivity of just sharing this information.
And remind us of why. Certainly not with the Russians.
Well, they're adversaries on many fronts. Now, both the Russians and the United States are against the Islamic State, but the Russians are backing Syria's president, Bashar Assad, and the U.S. and Russia have very different views about what the ultimate outcome should be in Syria, with the Russians wanting to keep Assad and the U.S. Not feeling that way.
So let's just say, for instance, this ally, this source, could have been someone in Syria who's actually fighting Assad, but giving information to the U.S., that person, if Russia can target them, they might. So talk about that concern that, you know, McMaster going out of his way to say that Donald Trump had no idea the source of this, implying that he didn't know the city. And the accusation by these unnamed officials in reports is that the name of the city where this source was given away.
Right. So this is what came out in the reports in The Washington Post and New York Times, that the city was named. And that would, in a sense, perhaps allow the Russians to reverse engineer this and figure out, well, wait a minute, the information is coming from this city, and therefore we can start tracking it down and we may be able to find this out. So that's the concern there, is that you're giving the Russians something to work with. You're potentially compromising a source that could be very, very valuable. If this person has access to such sensitive information in the Islamic State, they may know other important things about the way the Islamic State is thinking and where they feel vulnerable or what they're planning to do. So you would absolutely want to protect somebody that's this valuable.
Look, members of President Trump's own party, the Republican Ben Sasse, Bob Corker, who said the White House is in a downward spiral, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that White House controversies impede Republican goals. Here's a little of his interview with Bloomberg News today.
I think we could do with a little less drama from the White House on a lot of things so that we can focus on our agenda, which is the deregulations, tax reform, repealing and replacing Obamacare.
What do you see happening here? Might political pressure from within the Republican Party alter how President Trump is engaging with Russia?
Well, it hasn't worked so far. We've certainly had several of these controversies, and here's another one. I mean, what you noticed in that McConnell clip there is a lot of Republicans are speaking in passive voice. We'd like to see a little less drama. Well, you know, who's the source of this drama? Repeatedly, it's the president who's creating these sort of self-inflicted wounds or self-inflicted dramas that didn't exist. So that you do sense a bit of frustration, although they're not coming out and explicitly telling Trump Trump to do something differently. And again, he seems to be doing it almost casually or by accident. It's not a sort of a planned act on his part.
Well, some are wondering why his aides would go out of their way yesterday to deny the reports when apparently aides who were in the room in the meeting with the Russians immediately contacted the agencies to say that some information had gotten out. Those things are very traceable. But meantime, is there any sense that this could be payback? Many of these officials just had their boss fired by President Trump.
I don't think we have evidence to support that. It most likely went to the CIA and the NSA, not necessarily the FBI. So we don't know the source on that exactly.
Yeah. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Murray, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
President Trump has promised to revive the coal industry and bring back mining jobs, but he faces headwinds from a changing industry. Renewable energy is becoming more affordable. In Kentucky, a coal company is finding another use for an old surface mine. It's partnering with a global renewable energy giant to put a major solar installation on the site. Erica Peterson from Here and Now contributor WFPL reports.
It's a busy afternoon in downtown Pikeville, Kentucky. Parking is at a premium. At one end of town, people are setting up carnival rides for the annual festival called Hillbilly Days. At Small Town Tattoo, Clyde Harless is getting ready to tattoo a pair of lips on a young man's, well, posterior. Harless says the local coal industry has been hurting for years. The downturn has hurt his tattoo business, too.
When the coal industry was booming, we stayed, like, a lot busier. All the companies were like that.
Harless looks like a tattoo artist. His face is covered with ink. So are the other visible parts of his body. He says people come into the shop wanting coal-related tattoos all the time.
Like pickaxe, helmet, stuff like that.
That hasn't changed as more miners are laid off. In Pike County, there's been a 60% drop in the number of coal miners from 2009 to 2015. Most people, Harless says, are getting these tattoos for family or cultural reasons. But in Pikeville, even the coal companies are looking towards what's next, renewable energy.
For us, this is not a competition against coal in any way.
Ryan Johns works as a project developer for the Berkeley Energy Group. Berkeley considers itself foremost a coal company, but it's entering into a partnership with the renewable energy giant EDF to produce solar energy on one of Berkeley's mountaintop removal sites. After all the coal is gone, that is.
What we look at it is kind of an offset to coal. This area has been mined. There's no more coal to be mined. So now you can still have energy being provided from this area. It's still providing jobs. It's still helping the economy. It's still providing energy for our country.
The project is a large-scale solar array that would produce somewhere from 50 to 100 megawatts and sell the solar energy directly to a large company. Eastern Kentucky is in a regional energy market known as PJM. It's a big market, and project consultant Adam Edelin says there's lots of corporate demand.
Obviously, there are a lot of big companies out there who would love the opportunity to use renewable energy produced in Appalachia.
A lot of companies have self-imposed requirements to get a certain percentage of their energy from renewables. Edelin says the lack of available renewable energy is one factor that's discouraged large companies from relocating to Kentucky. Here's another disadvantage.
Kentucky does not have a renewable mandate. So for companies to come in, it is a little more of a risk for them.
Many other states require utilities to get a percentage of their energy from renewables. Berkeley Energy's Ryan Johns says if Kentucky did this too, it would help encourage other solar projects like this one.
That would be great. We think that would help to drive other businesses and stuff to come in. But whether that happens or not, we are going to go ahead with the project.
It's not easy to put solar panels on a reclaimed surface mine. You have to make sure the land is stable so the panels won't sink. But on the plus side, mines typically have access roads and established power lines.
Hey, are you Kenny?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty
Kenny
good.
Stanley was a coal miner for 18 years. Now he's working for Berkeley Energy. He drives me out of Pikeville through the tiny town of Zebulon. There's a billboard perched on a hill above us that reads, "Our past, our future, coal." We drive up the mountain and onto the mine site.
We had to put it in full driveway wheel.
This part of the mountain has been reclaimed with grasslands, but there's still coal being mined on an adjacent site. When the wind blows right, you can hear the distant sounds of machinery, but otherwise, it's quiet.
Now you'll have solar panels all the way around through here.
The site stretches on for several hundred acres, and if this solar project becomes a reality, there are a lot more sites just like it. In 2009, environmental nonprofit Appalachian Voices estimated that more than 1 million acres of land in Appalachia had been cleared by mountaintop removal coal mining. What would it mean for the struggling communities if solar fields started springing up on some of those sites?
It means real economic diversification.
This is project consultant Adam Edelin again.
Coal will see some revitalization, but I don't think anybody believes that its shoulders will ever be so large again that it can support the entire region. So what we're talking about doing is bringing in a new industry.
Part of the deal with EDF Renewable Energy is that the project will use current and laid-off coal miners in the construction phase, something Ryan Johns of Berkeley Energy says should be feasible without too much additional training. And who knows? Maybe the next generation of workers in Pikeville, Kentucky, will line up for tattoos of sunshine and solar panels from Clyde Harless at Small Town Tattoo. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Peterson.
Ohio is one of the states hit hardest by the opioid crisis, and now a dangerous new mix of opioids being called gray death is causing fatal overdoses there as well as in Alabama and Georgia. It may be what caused a police officer to accidentally overdose just by touching the drug on Friday in East Liverpool, Ohio. He was revived with multiple doses of Narcan. Joining us now is Mike DeWine, the Republican Attorney General of Ohio. Welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be with you. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, what is in this mixture called gray death, and when did you first start seeing it in Ohio?
Well, we have started to see it in the last several months. It is a combination of heroin, fentanyl, and something called U47700. So, you know, the latter two are synthetic opioids. I want to point out that we're continuing to see different combinations. You know, this epidemic in Ohio started with pain meds. People, unfortunately, progressed from pain meds to the heroin. And then shortly after that, we started seeing fentanyl being mixed in with the heroin. Now we're seeing fentanyl sometimes by itself. We're seeing carfentanil, which is this large animal tranquilizer that, you know, only zoos would have. And we see people taking that as well. So there's all kinds of different combinations. And, of course, what makes all this very dangerous is there's no quality control. You know, people who were taking a certain amount of heroin or a certain amount of pain meds, when this stuff is mixed together, frankly, they have no clue what they're taking.
Do you have any idea where this new stuff is coming from?
No, I really do not. You know, if you go back, the heroin, of course, today is almost exclusively in Ohio coming out of Mexico. The fentanyl, some of it may be produced locally, but we think most of it is being shipped in directly from China.
Do you think there's demand for it, or are people just unaware that they are taking these more potent, more dangerous drugs?
Well, the sad thing is that these drug dealers, are great marketers, and they're always hyping their product. And one of the ways they can hype their product is say that it has such and such in it. And what's really hard to believe, but we continue to see it, is that, you know, people who are taking this stuff, even though they're seeing people die from it, are always after a bigger high, a better high. So while I say they really don't know what they're taking for sure, which is true, and they certainly don't know the quantity that they're taking, what does come together is the addict's desire for a better high and the supplier's desire to make more money.
One of the other things we're hearing about gray death is that it can be absorbed through the skin, so it's dangerous even to handle. Is that something you're seeing?
You know, about 6 or 7 months ago, we put out a notice to all law enforcement in the state of Ohio to stop doing field tests. You know, law enforcement historically does field tests. They get some idea of what it is. Then they take it to our crime lab that we run in the Attorney General's office. So what we warn them about is don't field test it anymore, because the carfentanil can actually cause, a horrible reaction. It can cause death, I'm told, just by touching the skin. Hmm. So we just, we warn law enforcement, please be very, very careful. And I will tell you, in our crime labs that the state runs, that we have, fundamentally changed how we actually handle the drugs that are coming in. We're much, much more cautious than we've ever been in the past.
Ohio is one of the states with the highest rates of drug overdose deaths. It's been increasing every year for the past few years. Why do you think that is?
You know, I wish I knew. There's some things I do know. We think three-fourths of the people who are on heroin started on pain meds. So we see a movement from pain meds. Someone, for example, 45 years old, white male, blue-collar worker, and gets addicted to a pain med after he hurts his back or she hurts her back. And then they can't get the pain meds anymore or it's more difficult. Then they move over to heroin. The heroin in Ohio is about $10 to get started. And so they move over to that. So I think part of it is coming from the pain meds. The second thing that I would note is we've had a real change in culture. When I was a county prosecuting attorney in the 1970s, heroin was something that you would only find in the inner cities, a relatively small number of people. It was very sad and terrible for them, but it really did not impact the general population. And one of the reasons was that even among people who were doing drugs, there was this psychological barrier that stopped them from taking heroin. They looked at heroin as something that they simply would not do and just simply they wouldn't go that far. Today, that psychological barrier is just gone. It does not exist anymore at all. And so, I think these are a couple things that are causing this. I think the third thing is the Mexican drug cartels have developed a perfect business model. They grow the poppies in Mexico. They process it down there, turn it into heroin, they bring it into Ohio. They control it usually right down to the street level and right at the end sell it off to whoever the local drug dealers are. But they've developed kind of the pizza delivery system. For $10, you can start off on heroin. They'll bring it to you. They'll get it to you within 30 minutes. And what starts, though, as maybe a $10 a day habit may within 6 months or 7 months, when they're taking 100 times the dosage, maybe $1,000 a day habit. So in that sense, they've developed this absolutely perfect business model that, they're just making a ton of money.
Well, let me ask you about the second aspect you mentioned, which is the changing attitudes about heroin. Do you have a sense of why that is? Why people don't feel that it's as dangerous as I guess they used to?
No, I really don't know why people don't feel that, although there's great irony in this. We've made some significant progress in the last few decades in regard to how people view tobacco. And although there are still kids that are starting on it, that number is significantly down. It's really not looked upon as something cool or a neat thing to do. So we've moved the culture the right way in regard to tobacco. At the same time, however, you've seen the culture in regard to heroin go the other way. I'm not a sociologist. I can't tell you why that's happened, but I just see the results every single day in Ohio as we lose more and more people. What we've seen in Ohio is we're losing at least 10, 12 people every single day this year, but it's having, ramifications in so many other areas of Ohio. The epidemic has been here long enough so that we're some of our first babies that were born that were addicted, they're now in first grade and second grade, and we're seeing the impact there. Our children's services and our foster care system is bursting at the seams with kids because one or both of the parents are drug addicts. It's estimated that about half of all the children in Ohio who are in foster care are there primarily because one or both parents are drug addicts.
Do you think doctors in Ohio are over-prescribing opioids since, as you say, the problem often starts with people who get opioids to deal with an injury or something like that?
I think we've taken care of the doctors who are nothing more than drug dealers, and there weren't that many, but we've taken the licenses away of over 100 doctors. So we've got rid of the bad people. What we're left with, unfortunately, is a culture, and the culture has not totally changed. You had a couple things coming together about 15 years ago. You had doctors being told, hey, you're not taking care of pain for your patients. And at the same time, you had pharmaceutical companies coming out with new drugs, wonder drugs, that they told the doctors were, quote, not very addictive. The direct result of that was that you know, the number of pain meds that were prescribed went significantly up every year after that in Ohio. It was only within the last several years that we've started to see, you know, those numbers trend downward. And so we're very, very happy to see that. But I still think we have a little work to do. We still have some doctors who are very good people, but who are writing scripts that are just, you know, for much too many pain meds. We're seeing it sometimes with dentists, although dentists have made some progress. You know, we're still seeing kids 18, 19, 20 years old who are having their wisdom teeth taken out, and the dentist is prescribing 30 or 40 pain meds. And, you know, nothing good can come of that. The kid, you know, takes one or two and takes no more, and that's good, but then most people just keep that in their, you know, up in their medicine cabinet,
right.
And we get diversion as a result of that. So we have a ways to go, but I think we made some significant progress in regard to the culture among our doctors and dentists.
I'm sure you've seen the news that President Trump has talked about zeroing out the budget for the Office of the Drug Czar. What do you think about that, given the opioid crisis?
Well, I don't think that would be a good idea. You know, I think that it's important to have someone who's out there speaking about drugs every single day. And although in past administration, frankly, the so-called drug czar did not maybe have as much authority as members of the cabinet, and maybe did not have as much authority as I would have liked to see him or her have, I still think having someone who is focused on this every single day, who is out there talking with the media, you know, I think that's a plus, and I think it would be a shame to see that done away with.
Are you running for governor?
No official announcement yet, but you know, I don't think there's any doubt. Anyone who's been around me for the last few years, I'm very interested in the job of governor. I think, I prepared my whole life for this job. And, you know, looking forward to making an announcement about that sometime in the next few months.
That's Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
How much caffeine is too much for kids? It's a question much on our minds after learning today that 16-year-old Davis Cripe of Chapin, South Carolina, died last month after drinking a large Diet Mountain Dew, a cafe latte from McDonald's, and an energy drink, all within 2 hours at school. Kathleen Miller is a senior research scientist with the Research Institute on Addictions at State University of New York at Buffalo. Dr. Miller, the coroner says there were no underlying problems, no undiagnosed heart conditions. Davis was healthy, active, anti-drugs. They think the fault was squarely in the caffeine. How much caffeine is in these drinks?
Well, it kind of depends on which drink you're looking at, but most mainline energy drinks have about 10 milligrams of caffeine per ounce. Now, that's a little bit weaker than a strongly brewed cup of coffee. It's about 3 times stronger than most soft drinks.
And within 2 hours, having, you know, 3 sets of caffeine, is that part of the problem, that it was so much in such a short period of time?
It's very likely that the time frame was the key issue here. It's surprising and unusual that there were no undiagnosed heart conditions involved. In this case, it would be interesting to know how big an energy drink we're talking about here, because
right,
some of them can be multi-serving cans.
Well, they haven't yet named the drink, but they're saying that these energy drinks might affect young, healthy people differently. There was a 2015 Mayo Clinic study showing that an energy drink can increase the blood pressure of healthy young adults, as well as hormone levels,
mm-hmm,
and can raise the risk of cardiovascular events. Have you been looking at this, energy drinks and specifically young people?
My research is mostly about the behavioral implications of energy drink use in young people, the fact that it's associated with other risk-taking behaviors. But there is some fairly good initial research suggesting that energy drinks are about more than just caffeine. There are a couple of possible reasons why energy drinks might affect people differently than just, say, a cup of coffee. One is that they are consumed differently. They're caffeinated, they're cold, and all of the marketing around them suggests that people should drink them quickly. You don't just sip an energy drink. You're supposed to slam the whole can. Mm. It's also possible that some of the other ingredients in energy drinks are playing a role here. There are also other stimulants and various plant and herbal extracts and amino acids, and we don't really have a good sense of how those interact with each other.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned the study of elevation of blood pressure and stress hormone levels in healthy young adults, mm-hmm. but also the blood pressure of energy drink consumers remains significantly elevated by the time the blood pressure of caffeinated water drinkers returns to normal, so it has a longer effect.
It certainly sounds like it. But again, there isn't all that much research that's definitive yet on this.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, the parents of Davis Cripe are begging kids, you know, this wasn't a car crash. This was an energy drink. It took his life. Stop buying them.
Absolutely tragic for them. But even if you set the energy drink aside, caffeine in the Diet Mountain Dew and in the latte, that's also caffeine, and caffeine is a drug. We don't think of it as a drug because everybody uses it. It's the only cradle-to-grave legal drug there is in this country. Mm. And for most of us, it's largely harmless. But for a few of us, it can be potentially lethal.
Kathleen Miller, Senior Research Scientist with the Research Institute on Addictions at State University of New York at Buffalo. Dr. Miller, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
And she tells us one reason there is so little research on energy drinks is that they are considered supplements. We'll follow this here and now.
In the 1840s, Henry David Thoreau moved into a small house he had built on Walden Pond near Concord, Massachusetts. He went there as an experiment. He wanted to, quote, live deliberately, as he wrote in his now classic book, Walden, or Life in the Woods, which was published in 1854. Since then, Walden Pond has usually dominated his biography. But the author of a new book says there were other bodies of water that Thoreau cherished more than Walden Pond. They were the rivers that flowed around his hometown. Here and now's Alex Ashlock reports.
My window looks west. I see the ambrosial fog stretched over the river, as distinct as a pillow's edge. Henry David Thoreau, describing the view from his attic room in the family home. The river was the Concord, and he had placed his bed so he would see it first thing every morning.
Henry Thoreau is a man of the river. He was born on the river. He loved it. He felt its flow in his veins, and it, as he said, it meandereth forever in the bottom of his dreams.
Robert Thorson is author of the new book, The Boatman, Henry David Thoreau's River Years. On a recent spring day, the surface of the Concord was dotted with occasional raindrops.
And now it's like glass. And now the sun is coming through. And, of course, this is the time for birdsong.
Thorson is a professor of geology at the University of Connecticut. His earlier book, Walden Shore, placed Thoreau's literary legacy in a scientific context. His new book does that, too. He digs deep into Thoreau's journal to document his understanding of the way river systems work.
What Thoreau would do was lots of times he would just take his boat out and just sit and drift and drift and drift and drift. And so if it's life you're after, real life, the history of life, the ebb of life, the flow of life, the river is the place. If it's a moment in time and a moment of clarity and a moment of reprieve and a remove from that vigorous stream of life, then Walden Pond was the perfect place.
For Thoreau, the pond and the river were complementary forms.
The circle and the line make wonderful metaphors, okay? And Walden Pond is the circle, or the dot, if you like. And the river is the line. And when you think about that magical moment of your youth, Walden Pond is a great place. It's a moment in time that you may go back to over and over again. But when you think about your whole life, it's a line. you know, and there's these eddies and these rapids and these currents and these sluggish zones. It's a wonderful metaphor for life, and Henry Thoreau lived it his whole life. In fact, the episode at Walden Pond was a deviation away from a life spent on the river before and on the river after. In fact, there are big pieces of Walden that come straight from the river, but he's inventing a mythology here, so he doesn't want to tell you that outright. But there is one quote that gives itself away, and he says, "Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in." Well, that's because he's walking over to the Concord River and catching fish over there because it's richer, you know, to feed himself. Then when he comes back to Walden, he has more issues catching fish. He could always count on getting fish in the river, but not so much at Walden Pond.
Thoreau studied his rivers, measuring depth and temperature. He marked his map with sandbars and swimming holes. But he also used them as a highway, paddling, floating, and in winter he'd lace up his skates and take to the ice. One day he skated a total of 60 miles. In his journal, Thoreau delighted in the way the river marked the changing seasons.
Thoreau recalled one June sunset with special delight. It was shortly after dusk. Thousands of frogs were croaking in a deafening roar. A low mist hung above the water. In that direction, the sparkle of the planet Venus was multiplied by countless ripples, the light from each reflection haloed by the mist. Meanwhile, above the adjacent meadows, the, quote, coppery light of fireflies was multiplying as dusk gave way to dark. This was a river summer scene that no forest or field could match.
In essays like Civil Disobedience, Thoreau reflected on the relationship between the individual and society. Robert Thorson says his river explorations helped him understand the complicated relationship between man and the environment.
Thoreau, as a boatman, knows that his boating is improved by the human interventions. The Assabit is a livelier stream for him because of all of that flux of sediment. If you like white water, if you like ripples, if you like gravel, you know, I mean, that's a product of the watershed changes happening in the Assabit, which has a steeper slope. And if you like sailing, well, then, you know, a downstream dam that causes the river to be more sluggish gives you better sailing. Cutting down the trees, you know, give you more breeze to go sailing. These are things that happen when human beings modify the landscape for their own needs, and he's taking advantage of them. And this is the opposite of Walden. Walden is, you know, the guy's in town, he's frustrated with the market revolution, he has all kinds of problems and issues, and that's a very, very complicated story. But the upshot is that he removes himself to the edge of society where he can remove himself from a landscape, and he goes to the place that's an outback that has been less disturbed than anywhere else because it isn't worth much. You know, the river is completely disturbed because it's worth a lot and people are managing it for themselves. So he goes to Walden Pond and he writes an ode to purity and an ode to self-reflection and an ode to lots of wonderful things, but mostly spiritual, mostly coming of age, mostly learning to understand. It's a full immersion experience into nature, and it's fantastic. You know, but it requires nature as this sort of other that you can plug yourself into and be in that nature by living there. This is different. This is nature, the robins that we hear, you know, the trees that we see, the meadows that are here. They're all partially a product of human intervention with the landscape. And if we can quit whining, you know, about how we're changing the world so much, it's such a terrible place to be, and just say, well, let's just enjoy it. You know, let's be careful not to ruin things. I mean, we can ruin things. We are ruining certain things. But let's not become so negative about it that we can't appreciate, you know, the nature that we're fully entangled with. And I really like the word entangled because there's no suggestion of control. There's this suggestion that human beings they're part and parcel of nature in a new way. You know, it's like they're threaded through here and there, and they're not necessarily on top or on the bottom.
After Walden was published in 1854, Thoreau filled his journal with entries about the three rivers closest to him: the Concord, the Assabet, and the Sudbury. But his time ran out. Suffering from tuberculosis, he was mostly homebound the last few years of his life. Thorson writes about Thoreau's final days.
By mid-April 1862, Henry's death was imminent. At his request, his bed was moved downstairs from his isolated third-floor sanctum to the front parlor on the main level. Never again would he see the sun sparkling over the river at his boat place through the window. Shortly before his downstairs move, Henry was visited by his old friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wanted to pay his respects and say goodbye. Emerson recalled the water view from the western window, the river view, and he remembered the way Henry spoke of the river as if it were another old friend he'd known for a lifetime. Emerson later recorded Thoreau's final autobiographical comparison between his life and that of a river. Quote, "Henry praised to me the manners of an old, established, calm, well-behaved river as distinguished from those of a new river. A new river is a torrent, an old one slow and steadily supplied." Unquote. The younger Thoreau was a boatman with wild, agitated, idealistic ideas. The older Thoreau was a boatman whose mature flow of thoughts was slower and steadier. Emerson finished his entry with his friend's final words on the topic. Quote, "What happens in any part of an old river relates to what befalls it in every other part." Unquote. Metaphorically, the moments of our lives and the movements of our rivers finally all flow together.
Robert Thorson, reading from his new book, The Boatman, Henry David Thoreau's River Years. Thoreau died on May 6, 1862, at the age of 44. On the morning he died, he said to his sister Sophia, "Now comes good sailing." For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
New York could become the first state to use a device being called a textilizer, like a breathalyzer, only it would test phones at crash sites, not to see content, but just to see if a driver used the phone just before the accident. Other states are also considering the devices, but as we'll hear, there are concerns about drivers' rights. Let's bring in Ben Lieberman. He's been working on developing the textilizer with an Israeli company while New York considers using it. Ben's 19-year-old son, Evan, was killed 6 years ago, a passenger in a car that crashed while the driver was texting. He joins us by Skype. And Ben, terrible loss. So sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Means a lot.
And you know that the driver was texting because you had to launch a lawsuit and spend months in court to find that out.
Yeah, it was a difficult process. After any kind of crash, there's always some sort of a suit to get a hold of the different insurance proceeds. And I wouldn't settle the case until I got a hold of the cell phone records.
Yeah. But you had to get warrants and such to do that. What are you talking about with the law that New York is considering and this device? What would it do?
Well, what the law would do would allow police to use technology that we've developed that would allow the police to, at the scene of a crash, to be able to determine whether somebody was actively using the device illegally. That's a key area that's missing right now.
Well, people are very surprised when they hear this. They think there's laws against texting and driving. So naturally, if you're stopped or if an officer sees you, thinks you're texting, you can be pulled over. But what? Can you not just take someone's phone now?
Yeah, that's the biggest misconception that's out there. And I'm not going to say that I didn't have the same misconception. You know, I learned the hard way. When you hear so much about distracted driving and how bad it is and how prevalent it is, you would assume that common sense is dictating that this is going on. But it's absolutely not. And you know, when I speak at schools, I bring up a statistic from 2014 where there were 258,000 crashes in the year 2014. And I'm talking about New York State. And I asked the crowd, how many of those do you think were reported as texting and driving? And the answers I get are anywhere from a third to a half. And the answer is shocking because the answer is only 64 people. And that's because while a police officer can see somebody texting while they're driving, when it comes to a crash, they can't do anything about it unless there's an eyewitness or an unlikely confession.
Or like you, somebody goes and gets warrants to get access to the contents of a phone. Look, why not just rely on that? You know there are concerns that this device, although the device maker says that it will not collect data at all, it will only show that the phone's been used, and then that gives the police or the courts the right to go and get a warrant. But since there are concerns about privacy rights, why not just stay with the current system of getting the warrants and going through the courts?
Phone records are completely obsolete right now for the problem that exists. Sending a simple email, which is a very likely candidate for a distracted driving crash, That doesn't show up in a phone record, nor does social media and all the activity that's going on Facebook and Snapchat and that, browsing the web, app use, Pokemon Go, taking selfies. That's not showing up in phone records anyway.
So you're saying what your device would do is enable people to see the phone was used.
It's going to capture typing and swiping. And it could also determine illegal typing and swiping versus legal Bluetooth and voice activation. So the idea is to have an efficient but very respectful investigation.
That's Ben Lieberman. His son was killed by a driver who was texting. And Ben now co-runs an organization called DORCS. It stands for Distracted Operators Risk Casualties. They've come up with a device. New York State is considering a law that would allow the use of that device. Ben, thank you so much. We're going to stay with this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, let's just bring in for a couple of minutes Donna Lieberman, no relation. She's executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And Donna, we know that the union and others are objecting to this notion that somebody might be able to get data from phones. But Ben swears that that will not happen. It will just show usage, and you can later go for a warrant to see more. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, what this legislation would do is require all drivers to turn over their cell phones when asked by an officer at the scene of a traffic accident, and at risk of losing your license for a year and incurring a fine. That means that people who have done absolutely nothing wrong, have not engaged in distracted driving, will be subject to punishment.
But if these things become like breathalyzers, we know what they are. It's a textilizer. And all it's doing is showing if there's usage at the moment or up to the crash. Isn't that worth the few seconds that you might have sitting in the car there if you know you didn't use
Well, first of all, the technology that is being mandated and assumed exists has actually never been field tested, and there's actually never been any showing that it is so limited. But the information that is sought is readily available to the police or to a litigant based on a warrant or a subpoena. So why go around the warrant requirement with an invasion of privacy when it's not necessary? Nothing about this law will do what we really want to have done, which is to stop distracted driving. We have to adopt measures that don't just feel good to us, but that are effective in reducing the incidence of distracted driving.
That's Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We will continue following both sides of this debate. Donna, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, I'd love to hear listeners weigh in at hearnow.org, your thoughts on a textilizer. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.